This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.
I absolutely do not want to be the red-faced, angry dad in the Under Armour hat with the Oakley shades and the crummy goatee with his arms crossed in the dugout, you know, shouting. That's the kind of coach I don't want to be.
Welcome to How To. I'm Amanda Ripley. As a reporter, I've been in a lot of uncomfortable places. I've been in prisons, crack houses, hurricanes, but I never got as nervous as I did on the sidelines of a soccer field coaching a bunch of 10-year-old boys. I mean, I've played soccer my whole life, and I was always solidly mediocre, but through a series of events, I ended up coaching my son's soccer team for about 5 years. And I mean, I hate to admit this, but I can still remember my stomach tensing up during those games, the feeling of absolute elation when my players scored, and profound despair when they lost, all of which I hid from them, of course, most of the time. Anyway, it was just way harder than I expected, so I have a lot of sympathy for this week's listener.
My name is Kelly. I'm 46, live in just outside of Seattle, Washington.
Kelly is the father of two boys, aged 11 and 8. His younger son, Benjamin, is the athlete of the family.
So got him into t-ball a couple years ago and saw a real lack of participation from the other parents. So I after a lot of consternation and hand-wringing, volunteered to be the head coach for his boys' farm ball team.
Kelly didn't really play a lot of sports growing up, but he's still kind of a romantic when it comes to baseball. He even asked his team to call him Skipper.
It kind of harkens back maybe to simpler times, but I don't know. Being out on the field with your glove under the light is just very magical to me. And I want to help my son and his teammates find that joy in sports. And I didn't want to be the yelling dad, you know, throwing a clipboard or, but I have a little mixed results with how that turned out in real life.
Just like me, Kelly discovered that coaching pushed him to his limits right away.
I had no idea what I was doing as far as like running drills or teaching the game to these kids. And so I, you know, never ever got angry at somebody for striking out or booting a ground ball. Like they're making an honest effort, right? And then this is where I lost my cool a couple times. And I'd blow my top. Well, I mean, I'm not cursing or anything, but I chose to just yell at the kid through the dugout and shame him in front of both teams and all the families.
Of the 6.5 million youth sport coaches in the United States, just 1 in 10 have received any relevant training. Most coaches are just parents who volunteered after no one else would step up. And if it's done poorly, it can have real lasting damage on kids. So in today's show, we're giving Kelly a crash course in coaching from the coach's coach. Doug Lamov's previous book, Teach Like a Champion, is a kind of Bible for school instructors all over the world. It's so good, in fact, that professional baseball coaches started showing up at his trainings. Soon he started working with U.S. Soccer and eventually wrote a new book, The Coach's Guide to Teaching.
I don't think enough coaches start with the question of, like, why do I want to do this? And I think when that happens, you know, ambition and ego can easily step in.
Doug has some fantastic advice for commanding attention and managing failure that we can all learn from on or off the field. So let's get warmed up, and in the immortal words of Coach Taylor from Friday Night Lights.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose. Get loose!
This episode is brought to you by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Choiceology is a show all about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Each episode shares the latest research in behavioral science and dives into questions like, can we learn to make smarter decisions? Or what is the power of negative thinking? The show is hosted by Katie Milkman. She's an award-winning behavioral scientist, professor at the Wharton School, and author of the best-selling book, How to Change. In each episode, Katie talks to authors, athletes, Nobel laureates, and more about why we make irrational choices and how we can make better ones. Choiceology is out now. Listen and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast or find it wherever you listen.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
If you enjoy How To, the best way to support this show is by joining Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. Your contribution helps us produce the unique stories that you hear in our feed every week. It's only $1 for your first month. And in addition to supporting our journalism, members never hear an ad on a Slate podcast and never hit a paywall on the Slate website. Slate Plus members are essential to keeping this show going, so I hope you'll join if you're able. To sign up now, go to slate.com/howtoplus. Again, that's slate.com/howtoplus. In our popular imagination, there are generally two types of coaches. One is the maniac coach that Kelly's trying not to be, like Will Ferrell in the comedy Kicking and Screaming.
All right, let's break someone's clavicle on three. One, two, three, break someone's clavicle! Hit the field, let's go.
That's a trip, you know that?
Move it, move it!
Then there's everyone's new favorite coach, Ted Lasso.
For me, success is not about the wins and losses. It's about helping these young fellas be the best versions of themselves on and off the field.
Kelly is trying to be like Ted.
Yeah, that was the first thing that popped into my mind. I'm certainly not like him in that way. I don't have a lot of funny puns and whatnot. that's who I'd want to be, right? Is that that ultimate encourager?
And someone who prizes fairness as much as winning.
I created a dashboard in Excel that I managed playing time at every single position by percentages of games played. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't favoring anybody, especially my own kid who loved to play pitcher.
But when the final tournament of the season arrived, his competitive side started to show itself.
Once the stakes got higher and it was win or go home, my coaches talked me into abandoning the whole everybody plays the same percentage.
Out with the spreadsheet. Before we go any further, I wanted to ask our expert Doug Lamoff the million-dollar question. Should kids get equal playing time?
There should be some minimum that everyone gets to play and some equity to it. But perfect equity is not fairness. That, like, especially when some kids work really, really hard or do everything you ask them to do and are great teammates, like, there, at some point there should be reasonable rewards for extra effort. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good to know. Now let's see how that worked out for Kelly's team in the do or die semifinal game.
We were up for a good part of the game and we're feeling good and having fun, and just, you know, all of a sudden the wheels just come off and we lost. And after every game, we'd go circle up real quick in the outfield, and I would give out a game ball. The kids were in tears, and we were the Pirates, and we all had, like, Pittsburgh Pirate hats and gear, and the parents bought flags, and, you know, we had eye patches for the last picture and stuff, and it was just really sad that it was over, and I got choked up.
I mean, look, everybody's season ends with a loss except one team. one, the fact that they're upset shows that it matters to them, that they care about their performance and they care about the team. So like, that's a good thing. Part of it is just learning how to lose and how to deal with, you know, disappointment. Ritual is both like useful for helping people feel belonging, but also is a really important tool for helping people process difficult things. So like being able to go out to the outfield and give your game balls again, return them to a sense of normalcy and focus them on the things that we said were valuable all season long.
Here's our first pointer. Create rituals that build a sense of belonging and do them every time, win or lose, tears or no tears. We'll talk later about how to manage loss, but for now, figure out what's really important and back those values up with rituals. As Doug likes to say, you can get a lot wrong if you get the culture right.
Worse than the loss, like that was bad, it stings, but it was pretty quick. It was the, I had a couple kids, my son included, who had some bad slumps at the plate. And there, one kid who probably has the sweetest swing on the whole team, really good athlete, great kid, and just all of a sudden, like a case of the yips, he could not hit the ball, not even foul it off, couldn't make contact. And that went on for four or five games. He had family out to watch him, his grandparents or whatever came out, and his kid's in tears after the game, like, why is he crying? He's like, well, he's got his whole family here. Mm-hmm. And my heart broke for that kid. Every swing was just like a knife in my back. I was like, just please hit it, please hit it.
Yeah, there's value in failing and losing, and there's also like a tipping point, right, where it becomes like torture.
Yeah.
Doug, it seemed like most of the feedback really has to happen in practice, right? Like at the game, there's just very little that helps. Is that right?
I think that for the most part, that's true. There's very little you can teach during the game. What you can really do is remind players of things that you've taught them during practice. And the backstory on this is a working memory, which is the part of your brain that you think with consciously is really, really small. You can only keep sort of like one core idea in your head at a time. And so if someone's trying to play and you're trying to explain to them something new that you want them to do, one, they're not going to be able to do the new thing. And two, it's probably going to degrade their play. I'm not saying that's what's happening here, by the way. I'm just like sort of talking about the challenge of teaching during coaching.
Yeah. And I know the other coaches and parents and even some of the players, like they mean well, but they're like, get your elbow up, put your elbow down.
So yeah.
Move your feet this way, move your feet that way. And
like, when you start to struggle, everybody's got advice for you, right? Like it's.
That's our next pointer. Don't try to teach during games. It won't work. Teach at practice. Create catchphrases for each idea, shorthand cues you use over and over again to remind players later. But even in practice, resist the urge to say too much.
One of the most useful phrases about coaching that I've ever heard comes from a rugby coach in New Zealand who says, if you chase five rabbits, you catch none. And the idea is that I'm just imagining this kid at bat. Lift your elbow, step into it, watch the ball, relax, pay attention to your back foot, rotate your hips, right? Even if those were good pieces of advice, lots of times we try and make athletes better by trying to tell them lots of things to do at once. And the result is that you can't really concentrate on or follow through on any of them. And it just results in confusion in working memory. And so, interestingly, a couple weeks ago, I was working with a coach he's an assistant coach of an NBA team. One of the interesting things about watching the practice session is there are all these assistant coaches around. And so pretty much everything that a player does during this practice session, someone is commenting on it to the player. And so what we talked about was, one, like having coaches just have a clipboard and a place to write things down, right? So like we can actually make a strategic decision about the one thing to tell him to focus on, as opposed to like him just being harangued by this sea of feedback.
Here's another tip. Chase one rabbit at a time. Don't overwhelm players with feedback, even in practice. Keep all those other teachable moments on a clipboard for later use.
Yeah, this is our really good advice, actually, because there's so much going on during the game and the pressure is so high, and it's just a quick snapshot, whereas this should be done in practice. We are kind of fortunate, if there ever is a silver lining with COVID, that the parents had to be out in the outfield beyond the fence, that there was no sitting in the bleachers, right by the batter's box. We didn't have a lot of parents chirping.
And that's going to change, right? I assume
Yes.
Yeah. Doug, do you have any thoughts about how can a coach manage backseat coaching from parents?
That's so challenging. Because of course, often parents mean well by it, but they, you know, it can be very counterproductive, both to players' growth and to the culture that's happening on the field. And it's, you know, the better you get and the farther you go, the more challenging it's going to be.
Yeah, I bet.
So I think like having a preliminary conversation with parents at the beginning of the season, which is like, here's like, we need to be disciplined about not talking about umpires and referees, either during the game or even like, I can't control this, but like if you get in the car and the first thing you say to your son is, wow, the umps really cost us the game there, you're preventing them from thinking about, you know, what's useful for them, which is how did you play and what can you improve on, and or did you have a great time, et cetera. And so if I can communicate that to parents in advance, like we're trying to really work on our coverage and making sure that like we're always covering the right base and we're always throwing to the right base. And so if parents know what you're trying to accomplish, it's easier for them to be aligned in the things that they shout for from the sidelines.
That's a great idea, to give them something they should do rather than what they shouldn't do. I don't know, did you have this, Kelly? I don't know if they do this in baseball, but with our soccer league, they had silent Saturdays once a season where nobody was supposed to yell anything during the games. And it was like the parents hated it. It was so painful for them.
I know a coach who had a manager on it as a parent on the team. And it's just a parent who's good at this. And he gave the parent a bunch of lollipops. And the parent, and if there was another parent who was like not quite on the right side of productive and positive in the way and the things that he or she was shouting during the game, the parent would just hand them a lollipop. And the message was, that's what your mouth is for.
Here's our next pointer. As the coach, it's your job to manage the parents, set expectations at the beginning of the season, and tell parents what they can do, not just what they can't. All of which gets a lot more complicated when the championship rolls around, of course. All right, halftime team. When we come back, we'll tackle what to do when people stop being polite and start talking trash.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
All right, listen up, team. In the first half, we talked about how to be a good coach and manage the parents. But now it's crunch time and the game is on the line. What do you do if you're a good parent stuck with a bad coach? Doug found himself in that situation a few years ago with his daughter's elite soccer team.
The worst coach that my daughter ever had, she was the coach of the A team and my daughter was on the B team, and she came to like coach the B team because their coach was out that day and they weren't playing well. And at halftime, she was like, this is why you're the B team and not the A team, because you guys don't want it hard enough. And like, there was just a lot of like telling 14-year-old girls that their struggle was like a personality flaw on their part. And I moved my daughter to a different club after that.
Well, it's a lot like when your kid gets a teacher who is, undertrained and doing counterproductive things.
Then you probably have to think about stepping in as a parent, but I hesitate to say that out loud to parents because so many parents, use that tool in a counterproductive way, confronting the coach about like, my kid didn't start.
Yeah, right. Learning to deal with unpleasant people or situations is a life lesson, one that people come to sports for. But it's not an excuse for coaches to degrade or demean their players. There has to be a better way to motivate kids to try harder, right?
One of the things that interrupts the feeling of pleasure that players have is when there isn't a culture of error, which is when it's not safe to fail and when it's not safe to make mistakes. And so like a phrase that I was going to suggest to you Kelly, you described briefly, like shouting at the kid to cover second base, you know, like I think a really good phrase for using in practice is, I'm so glad I saw that mistake. Then we're going to study the mistake and it's actually going to be really interesting and I'm going to learn from it. And then I'm going to be happy because I understand the game better. I always think it's great to think about giving feedback to players in a way that expresses your belief and faith in them and also teaches them how to be better because that's what they want.
Here's our next few tips from the playbook. Capitalize on mistakes and turn them into learning opportunities. Don't be afraid to tell a kid they're wrong, but do it right. Doug says there's a few ways to do this. First, talk aspirations.
When you get to the next level, you're going to need that, you know, that ball's going to have to come out of your glove a little bit faster, so let's practice that now.
Second, set a challenge.
That was pretty good, but I want you to see if you can get the ball out of your glove even faster. So here's how I want you to field the ball, and you see if you can do it, you know, big league quality.
Third, assume the best when a player makes a poor decision.
I can see why you wanted to go to third there, right? You wanted to get the lead runner, but there's a force at second. And so in this case, I love that you're thinking about that. But in this case, the right decision is to throw to second.
Fourth, a lot of teachers and coaches use the praise sandwich. A compliment, then the criticism, then another compliment. But kids see right through that.
One time, actually, when I was a teacher, a student said this to me. She said, Mr. Lamov, when I want to know what you really thought of my paper, I skip down over all the nice things you say until you get to the word but, and then you tell me the truth. and what that tells me is that, like, she had learned to basically discount the positive because she knew it was always sort of obligatory. So when I use praise, I really want it to pop for players. And so I want to preserve it and not overuse it.
That sounds like a lot like parenting too, right? Not to overpraise.
Oh, yeah.
Kelly, does this resonate with you?
It does. And this is really awesome insight. I'm curious though, Doug, what you'd think about, we have the batting order. We shout it out. It's right there in the dugout. We always keep the same order. And kid's just sitting there on the bench, jabbing away with his buddies, doesn't have his gloves on, doesn't have his helmet, doesn't have his bat. And I will lose my cool, man. It's stuff like that that just felt very disrespectful to me and the team. And I lost it. And I told him, nope, you don't get the bat. We're skipping over you. You're going to lose your turn. And I'm shouting, too. I am yelling, not abusively, but my voice is
You're
high.
Frustrated.
I'm frustrated. And I'll feel bad about chewing that kid out probably for a while. But I'm wondering if you have any take on that. Like,
yeah, it's such a great question, a hard question. I think you've hit the nail on the head, which is like that is just one of the biggest challenges of coaching young athletes in particular is the attention gaps. Mm-hmm. And one thing is I think that when there are moments when I have to like correct a player in a more decisive way, whenever possible, I want to do it privately. And maybe I want to like, I have this phrase, it comes from a classroom. It comes from watching a video of a teacher where like one kid in the class laughs at another kid when she's trying to read something. And like, this is just like a big culture foul to her, right? Like you don't get laughed at for trying to struggle in the classroom. But she, instead of walking directly over to him, she walks a little bit of a loop like around the back of the classroom just to give herself like, you know, a second or two to compose herself, you know, and the research on this is like, if you can slow down your decision-making, even by a second, you know, you let your rational brain catch up. And so I might be like, Kevin, come on over here for a second. Okay. You missed your spot in the batting order. And that's a big deal, right? Cause it's part of our obligation to the team is to make sure we know what our job is and we're prepared and we're ready. You should be getting yourself mentally ready to hit. And so, and then every inning when you come back, I want you to go right to the batting order and check every time. And I want you to come tell me where you are in the order in that inning. And we're going to do that for the next three or four innings because I want you to build the habit of being alert and being attentive.
And this is like such a challenge with recreational sports, right? Is that some kids are really serious, deadly serious about it. And they really want to win. And they really want to get better. And other kids really could not care less. They just want to goof around. They want to chase the butterflies, like you said.
But I think that kids like that are often more responsive to peer-to-peer accountability than they are to adult accountability.
Yeah, that's you've given us three tactical ideas for managing behavior. One is make it private. Don't do it in public, like pull a kid aside. Mm-hmm. And the next is suggest a replacement behavior. So again, something you can do rather than what you shouldn't do. And then the third is like create systems, ideally peer-to-peer systems, right? So that it's automatic. Yeah. Kelly, what do you think about all this? Could you imagine creating a system that you could for figuring out who's next at bat?
Yeah, I can. I mean, part of it too is like I'm feeling embarrassed, right, by the families who are watching now. Like, oh, Skip's not organized here.
Yeah,
he doesn't have, you know, he's not in charge. These kids are all over the place, and you know, I, and my cheeks get all red, and I get, you know, and then just the needle starts to move, and I lost my cool, and I wish I had been armed with information like that, you know.
And this is also like parenting, right? Like the moments I regret most, and maybe this is just me, but the moments I most regret from parenting are when I was embarrassed, you know? So then it's like it triggers something where I'm like, you know, I get too involved. Again, it comes back to like the ego, right? Like it's somehow a reflection of me as a parent that this kid is having a tantrum in public. And when I started coaching soccer, you know, they make you take the little for the rec level license, like the little online training. And literally everything my coaches did when I was a kid in the 80s, they said not to do, you know, especially, you know, wait in line for drills. No, no, no. Run laps as a punishment. No, no, no. And so, but I admit there was a dark moment where we had some kids run laps because we just didn't know what else to do. Like,
yeah, I would have kids do push-ups sometimes. Then as afterwards, like, what am I doing? These kids don't even know how to do
push-ups. I know,
push-ups
are so bad. It's just...
They're bad. They're so terrible. Bad. And then they kind of want to do them and show off anyway.
Right, so now you've like rewarded
not even
them.
Really, right. Yeah.
Well, in some ways, but also, like, sometimes a kid wants to do push-ups because they want to pay you back, right? They want to set the account.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Straight, which is, I just think it's interesting. Like, I'm not totally sure that it's always wrong to teach kids to pay attention.
One good thing about doing the push-ups is it prevents you from giving a lecture, right? Like this is something that comes up a lot in the book and in Teach Like a Champion and I mean all your work, right? And it haunts me to this day because it's like, say less, do more.
One benefit of it is it's right away. And there's a lot of social science research that says a much smaller consequence immediate to the behavior that you're trying to change is much more effective than even a much larger consequence that comes later.
Okay, so everybody loses it once in a while. Do you recommend apologizing if you do lose it?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I think if we want students to be comfortable making mistakes, we have to be comfortable making mistakes. Yeah. And I just think, like, you know, accountability is a lot of what sports are about as well, what life is about. Yeah, I think it's important to be able to be accountable.
That's encouraging. Kelly, I wonder if, has this been helpful? What's kind of sticking with you?
Very much so. And what's stuck with me the most here that I'm going to take away from this are, like, it's okay to forgive yourself, for one.
Yeah.
I beat myself up a lot. Like, I'm not ruining their lives. You know, my ego was all wrapped up in eight-year-olds throwing and catching on the field, where it's like, you know, what are we trying to do here? And, like, keeping that perspective is going to be very, very helpful for me in the future. So I thank you very much for that.
Can I just say, like, you bring so much self-awareness and self-reflection to your coaching that I'd be great if everyone's kid got to play for a coach who approached it that way and was as humble and self-reflective. So, you know, don't, I would say doubly don't kick yourself around, because I just think you bring a lot of that, and that's, kids deserve that.
We got to have the memory of a goldfish, right? As Ted Lasso would say.
There you go.
Yeah, exactly. And I always tell the kids that too, right? You got to forget about your last at bat.
Coach, I'm sorry. You know what the happiest animal on earth is? It's a goldfish. You know why?
No.
Got a 10-second memory. Be a goldfish, Sam. Yeah?
Today's game ball goes to Kelly for sharing his story with us and for his willingness to learn. A big thank you to our skipper for this episode, Doug Lamov. Make sure to look for his book, The Coach's Guide to Teaching. And by the way, we did get an email from Kelly. He wasn't sure he was going to coach again next spring, but after our conversation, he's decided to give it another go. Go Pirates! Is your team in a slump? Are you stuck in a losing streak? Send us a note at howto@slate.com or leave us a message at 646-495-4001. And who knows, we might have you on the show. And if you like what you heard today, please give us a rating and a review and tell a friend. That helps us help more people. How To's executive producer is Derek John. Rosemary Belson produces the show. Our theme music is by Hannes Brown, remixed by Merritt Jacob, our technical director. I'm Amanda Ripley. Thanks for listening.